From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Governor Gavin Newsom still has one more state appointment to fill, Attorney General. Find out which California Congress member might be eyeballing that job that could set up an even bigger job a few years from now. Plus, 6 years ago, the words "Oscars so white" put Hollywood's flawed merit system under a spotlight. We'll hear how far it's come since. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, April Rain galvanized Hollywood back in 2015 when she tweeted out the hashtag OscarsSoWhite. And though change has been slow, it's carried weight ever since.
The media and others as well said, hey, one time is a fluke, two or more times is a pattern. So maybe she actually has something here. Let's dive into it further.
We'll hear from April Rain in about 20 minutes. But first, from November 2016 all the way up until November 2020, the relationship between California and Washington, D.C. was, well, how about this, terse and tense. But how about since? California. Yeah, it seems that so far, with Kamala Harris as vice president and other Californians tapped for high-profile roles in the Biden administration, the connection between D.C. and California has been very clear to see. So, with the Golden State in the national spotlight so much lately, we turn to one of our favorite political observers, Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, welcome back.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right, let's start with the story that's been a little bit under the radar. Congressman Adam Schiff is coming off an easy re-election in the 28th district, but there's some scuttlebutt out there that he could be looking to leave Congress only to set up a return. So, Carla, what's that all about?
Yeah, both Politico and Axios are reporting today that Schiff is lobbying Gavin Newsom to be appointed to the role of the Attorney General in California. And, you know, remember, Schiff is not only a former prosecutor and a Harvard Law graduate, he's one of the most high profile House members on Capitol Hill. He was the chair of the House Intel Committee. He had the lead in Trump's first impeachment. And with Javier Becerra, the California AG, being the Biden nominee for Health and Human Services Secretary, he's expected to be confirmed at any time. Schiff is reported to have moved himself into the mix as the pressure is on Newsom from a very crowded field, I must say. I mean, at this point, a lot of Democrats are pressuring for diversity, for Newsom to look at communities that haven't been traditionally represented. But in the past week or so, I'm saying you're hearing Democrats say the priorities have to be Newsom needs a team player who knows what he or she is doing, who can raise money, a legal star, and who can run the top law enforcement agency in the country aside from the U.S. government. A lot of people say that is Adam Schiff.
Now, we reached out to Schiff's office for comments so far. I haven't heard back yet, though. But explain how the attorney general job in California, Carla, could set up Schiff for a return to D.C., though.
I mean, this is a seat that's really second only to the governor for its high profile. It's definitely been a springboard to higher office. It's a department that employs over 1,000 attorneys and almost 4,000 non-attorney employees. It's got a budget of $1 billion. So we're talking about clout here. Jerry Brown was attorney general. Kamala Harris was attorney general. We know they both went on to other political assignments at a higher level. And so people are speculating that, you know, should Adam Schiff become AG here in California? Well, Dianne Feinstein's Senate seat comes up in 2024. The governor's seat comes up in 2026 if Newsom gets a second term. So it would position Adam Schiff to be where maybe he wants to be going into the future of California.
Where do all the relevant power brokers stand on this?
The biggest voice, I think, is Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker. For a long time, it was thought that she was not going to approve any of her members moving on either to the administration or to jobs like this because her majority is already very thin in the House, 221 to 211 right now, doesn't give her a lot of moving room there. But the fact is that a number of those Democrats who were going to go into the administration have since not have stayed. And right now, it looks like Pelosi has maybe one or two seats she can spare. She's close to Adam Schiff. Governor Newsom is too. So this could be maybe he's the last one out the door if he gets his seat.
And today, Gavin Newsom was in Oakland at the Coliseum where the A's play and was asked about where the AG process stands.
I'm very close to making that decision. Some extraordinary people that have not only sought consideration, some that haven't sought consideration that I believe would make outstanding attorney general. But we're very close to making that decision.
Carla, I saw State Assembly member Rob Bonta standing behind Newsom this morning, and he has some support from some of Newsom's advisors. Carla, wondering, though, considering all of the big names that we've thrown in the mix here, how much is Newsom in the middle of a Sacramento-D.C. tug of war?
I mean, he really is. It's a very aggressive tug of war because you've got a lot of national interests involved in this. Like, for instance, the LGBT community, they're pushing very hard for Rick Chavez, who heads Equality California, one of the leading advocacy groups for the LGBT community. He's also running for LA city attorney. The Asian Pacific Islanders are advocating for Bont, as you mentioned. Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg is there. I mean, at this point, I think no one can predict where Newsom's going to go on it. But I think a few weeks ago, people were saying Adam Schiff was a long shot because in an age of diversity, maybe a white man wasn't going to be as high on the list for Newsom. But remember, he's appointed Alex Padilla as the U.S. Senator and Shirley Weber as the Secretary of State, who's African-American. And people are saying that right now, Adam Schiff may have the advantage politically in D.C. and here and the attributes professionally to withstand the heat that it's going to take for the next AG of California to be able to do.
We're talking Golden State politics with Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. All right, now to the newest U.S. senator from California. That's Alex Padilla, who, Carla, seems to be starting to get his bearings in D.C. What's up with him lately?
You know, Alex Padilla is another one who has some very powerful friends as he takes his seat in the Senate. It is clear those friends have helped him, Kamala Harris and Dianne Feinstein among them. And he has already landed the kind of plum assignments that sometimes it takes newbies there in the Senate years to get. He got a seat on the Environment and Public Works Committee that is going to matter when it comes to water, climate, other issues in California, homeland security, and governmental affairs. That's another one. Harris was the only person of color there. Padilla, of course, is California's first Latino senator. That's going to be important. And the Judiciary Committee, which, of course, Senator Feinstein was the ranking member on. That's the one that has high profile questioning when it comes to judicial assignments and shaping major policies in California. And Padilla also gets a seat on the Budget and Rules Committee. That is a big one for clout in the Senate. So when it comes down to it, all of these give him an opportunity. He's going to be raising his national profile the same way it did for Kamala Harris. This has been a big moment for him, and he has come through with some film assignments.
And I know that Padilla is the new guy on the block, right? But is he sort of replacing Feinstein? Did Feinstein kind of pick her replacement on the Judiciary Committee? She's the ranking member, or was the ranking member.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, remember, she's a good friend and she's been a mentor to Padilla. He's not replacing her yet because it doesn't look like she's going anywhere, at least for a while. But it does position him to be somebody who could be a major player on that very high profile committee and give him a springboard to more. There's no question.
Okay. Now, another Californian in the national political conversation just got their ticket punched to D.C. Who is it?
That's Alejandro Mayorkas, who was confirmed as Secretary of Homeland Security. This is a real Californian, a graduate of UC Berkeley, a graduate of Loyola Law School. He is the first Latino, the first immigrant to head that agency. His mother, a Holocaust survivor from a family of Holocaust survivors, Cuban and Jewish at the same time. This was the tightest margin so far of Biden nominees, but he's got a very big agenda carrying out immigration, looking for domestic terror threats, helping to coordinate vaccine distribution. So as one of the architects of DACA, this is somebody who's being celebrated in the immigrant community. And he was raised in Beverly Hills, so we got California roots all over the place on this one.
Yeah, there's a lot of cross-section right there with Mayorkas. He checks off a lot of boxes. I know the vote for him was pretty tight in the Senate. Any word on why?
Yeah, he really was one of the first of Biden's nominees to get real pushback from the Senate Republicans. Mitch McConnell had some very tough words for him, calling him an ethically compromised partisan lawyer, basically saying that he shouldn't even been put up for appointment. The bottom line is, I mean, some of these Republicans talked about an inspector general report that suggested that Mayorkas had intervened to help foreign investors connected to Democrats get green cards. But the bottom line is, when you're dealing with citizenship and immigration, this is an area where the Democrats and the Republicans have really butted heads. And I think that's where a lot of the opposition came from.
Considering the many different tasks that the DHS secretary has, what might be his first one? I'm thinking about immigration because Biden's made that a priority right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. And DACA, of course. I mean, this is a guy who was one of the architects of DACA. He's been talking about protecting those kids. And we're talking about family reunification is one of the first places where Biden went, has already signed initiatives to undo much of the Trump, what he has called a stain on the country and a stain on the immigration record. So Mayorkas will be front and center in all of those.
Finally, Carla, you have a story in Politico about how the push to recall Gavin Newsom keeps gaining momentum. It seems every single day there's a new little push.
And I think that's because, look, Donald Trump is no longer clickbait. He's gone from Twitter. He's gone from social media. And the Republican Party and Republican grassroots is looking for something to fire up its people. And Gavin Newsom is the new face that is doing that. He is being featured now on Hannity, on Fox News, on Newsmax. This recall is becoming the story of the year for a lot of the people on the right. And you're watching some big names start giving money toward the recall. We get the Silicon Valley tech billionaire Chamath Palihapitiya, who just put in $100,000, even though he's not running for governor officially. But the fact is that, look, Republicans are looking at this as a way to juice up their grassroots in a year when Donald Trump is no longer there to do it for them. So this is going to be interesting to watch. And a lot is at stake for Gavin Newsom, given his poll numbers showing they've been tanking in the recent months.
Yeah, and I know this is a serious subject, Carla. I mean, it's a recall. It affects so many different things to have this, especially with a pandemic going on. But I got to say something. Some of the memes on Gavin Newsom, I'm telling you, they're just hilarious. I want to not laugh, but I can't stop laughing. One of them, it has his face and has the phrase, Texas's top realtor.
This is the kind of thing, you're absolutely right, A. Gavin Newsom is taking it on social media. A lot of this is being fired up by those recall people, and he's going to have to get used to it. The bottom line is he's got to deliver on those vaccines. He announced today two new major sites at Cal State LA and at the Oakland Coliseum. And he's got to reopen the schools. If he does that, that's going to pull the rug out from under the recall movement in a big way. But that is a heavy lift he's got coming this year.
That's Carla Marinucci, senior writer for Politico's California Playbook. Carla, as always, thanks a lot.
Always good to be with you. Thanks.
Nominations for the Golden Globe Awards are out. The Academy reveals theirs in March. You know, taking a closer look at and scrutinizing the names of the people Hollywood chooses to honor really hasn't been quite the same since April Rain put three words together behind a hashtag 6 years ago, Oscars So White. We'll hear how far she thinks Hollywood has come since. That's coming up when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Look around until I found someone who laughs like you. I know somewhere.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. Me, Martinez. In Los Angeles County, black babies are three times more likely to die before their first birthday than white babies. And black moms are four times more likely to die in childbirth. KPCC's Mariana Dale introduces us to two L.A. midwives working to reverse decades of health disparities for women of color at their new community-funded birthing center.
Kindred Space LA co-founder and midwife Kimberly Durden had walked by a squat building on Southwest Drive in Hyde Park near her home for years.
I always knew this property as like this building right before you get to the liquor store. It wasn't very pretty on the outside at all.
But open the frosted glass doors now and it's all exposed brick and tall wood beam ceilings. In the birthing suite, clients can labor laying on a bed, standing, submerged in a tub or in the shower. They're not restricted.
We're treating folks based on their individual needs and desires.
Durden and co-founder Allegra Hill believe the individualized care they provide as black midwives is one way to help reverse a long history of wide disparities in infant mortality and maternal health care.
Allegra and I haven't been comfortable just being like, all this terrible stuff is happening, that really sucks. We have literally pledged our lives at this moment to be a part of the solution.
Kindred Space LA was previously based out of a Ladera Heights office building. The midwives helped people have their babies at home and offered in-person gatherings for childbirth education and parent support groups.
Lots of people getting together, lots of hugging, lots of crying.
All of that stopped and eventually went virtual at the onset of the coronavirus pandemic.
It was like the universe was telling us like our time there was done and it was time for us to now focus on creating the space where families could come to birth.
This was always a part of the long-term plan. Durden and Hill want to serve people with Medi-Cal, but without their own facility, the low payments made it untenable. The fundraiser for the birthing center went live on Mother's Day 2020. They're now more than a third of the way to their goal of $300,000.
This space doesn't really belong to us. It feels like it belongs to everybody. And we're constantly trying to figure out how to let our community benefit from this space.
As a Black-owned birthing center, Kindred Space LA is unique. There are relatively few African-American midwives, despite a long history in this country. Keisha Good is a New York City sociologist and writing a book about Black midwifery. She says early 20th century obstetricians often pushed out birth workers.
They also participated in a racist, sexist, classist campaign, labeling Black and Indigenous and immigrant midwives as dirty or lacking hygiene.
Good says less than 2% of the country's estimated 15,000 midwives are Black.
They never went away. They were just systematically disenfranchised.
Allegra Hill says that's one reason Kindred Space LA is also training new birth workers of color.
They'll be able to come here and learn community-based care from midwives who look like them.
And eventually go on to serve clients like Nicole Hamad. She recently came into the center for a postpartum appointment with Durden.
So you're a mom of two now. Is it sinking in?
Every day.
Her son Amari was born at home in November with a midwife's help.
There are ways that you can labor so that you're not in excruciating pain. And it worked. And not once during my home birth did I say I want an epidural. I knew that I could do this.
Near the end of her visit, Hill asked Hamad for feedback.
You know, I trusted people. I just felt really cared for.
Hill says later in an interview, it's part of what they want for all their clients.
Feeling empowered in your birth is something that you carry with you forever.
Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
Okay, so 2020 was rough. We can all agree on that. We all went through a lot, and 2021 is exactly starting off smoothly. But much of the sweeping change we've seen, especially society's shift in how we talk about race, has centered around the Black community. So with that in mind, we've partnered with our friends over at LAIST to bring you the voices of notable Black men and Black women who have made meaningful contributions to our conversations around race and the city of Los Angeles. Today, we bring you April Rain. In January of 2015, she created the hashtag OscarsSoWhite, calling out the Academy Awards for its lack of diversity after nominations that year included pretty much all white people. Now, the seemingly very simple tweet unexpectedly launched a viral referendum on the disparities and inequities experienced by blacks and people of color in Hollywood. Here's April Rain in her own words.
Listen to the song here in my heart.
I've always felt the need to use my privilege to help other folks. I recognize as a black woman, I will suffer at the hands of racism and sexism, but I still hold privilege as an able-bodied person. I still hold privilege as a cis heteronormative person. And so it's my responsibility to stand in the gap for those who are more marginalized and hopefully, you know, allow them, provide space for them to do what it is that they need to do. OscarsSoWhite happened in January of 2015. And I would love to tell the story that it was very intentional. And, you know, I was sitting with a team around a mahogany conference room table. But that's not what happened at all. I have always attempted to use my platform to speak out about injustices of various kinds. You know, and social media, specifically Twitter, became my platform. And on that particular day in January of 2015, it struck me that there were no people of color nominated for any of the acting categories, despite very talented performances that year. So I jumped on Twitter and said, OscarsSoWhite, they asked to touch my hair. And so, you know, I said, OscarsSoWhite, they asked to touch my hair, because that would be an immediate touchstone to the black community, especially black women, who for centuries have had non-relatives, very often strangers, ask to touch our hair, or even worse, touch our hair without even asking, as if what grows out of our head is somehow different than what grows out of someone else's. I had no idea that it would become, you know, the viral hashtag that it has. You know, I will say that OscarsSoWhite was not my first viral hashtag and was not my last. So I had experience of what it feels like when something that you say, you know, as a random comment sends shockwaves. I created OscarsSoWhite in January of 2015. In January of 2016, the Oscar nominations came out again, and for the second year in a row, there were no people of color nominated for any of the acting categories, 20 slots. And so that is, you know, year two is when OscarsSoWhite really took off, because I think a lot in the media and others as well said, okay, one time is a fluke, two or more times is a pattern. So maybe she actually has something here. Let's dive into it further. Many of the award shows, including the Oscars, do not require its membership to view the performances before they vote. So if you're not watching the movies, how can you decide what the best performance is? And if that is the case, and we know the Academy is still, despite its slight improvement, is overwhelmingly white and male, what we're talking about is truly a popularity contest amongst older white men. You know, there is a reason why we get a war film every November or December, because, you know, white men love to blow things up, whatever that is. There's also a reason why many of the films that we see that depict an aspect of black life that are helmed by white directors and or white producers involve black trauma, very often enslavement. It is when we have directors and producers and screenwriters of color that we get movies that are more nuanced, that are more gentle, that are not steeped in trauma.
Let my people go.
It's incredibly disheartening when someone from a marginalized community wins an award and there is immediately an asterisk, you know, and, oh, well, only one because, you know, or because of the backlash to the lack of diversity and inclusion, you know, so-and-so decided. Well, that can't be the case, right? Because, again, we know who the voters are. Black people, very often, we have to be twice as good to get half as far. You know, we have to work doubly hard all the time just to get our foot in the door. Weight on my shoulders. I want the legacy of Oscar So White to be normalizing inclusion in the entertainment industry. We are by no means there yet. And the way that people on social media very often are calling out these issues with respect to diversity and equity and inclusion, I think is the true progress, because the entertainment industry, like all other industries, ebbs and flows based on the financial bottom line. And if less people are watching the TV show or going to the film, then that is what's going to make Hollywood truly stand up and take notice when their pockets are affected.
That's April Rain. She created the OscarSoWhite hashtag back in 2015 that continues to galvanize and challenge Hollywood. All right, you might have heard Jeff Bezos stepping down as CEO of Amazon. 25 years he's done that job. Well, you know, I'm pretty sure that our packages will still be delivered. I'm really wondering what it'll mean for Amazon Studios delivering all those streaming shows and movies. Find out when Take-Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, and you can also find us on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. All right, we've officially entered Hollywood's most unconventional award season ever. Rival movie studios rush to make GameStop movies, and Apple spends big at Sundance. For this and more, it's time to go on the lot.
God is my witness.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Joining us, as always, Rebecca Keegan, senior editor for film for The Hollywood Reporter. All right, Rebecca, this morning the Hollywood Foreign Press Association announced the Golden Globes nominations, and every year there are surprises in this show, so remind us first, who votes for these awards?
The Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is about 90 journalists from about 55 countries, is who votes for the Golden Globes. They're not people who work in the film industry. They're not film critics. They're not general audiences. Frankly, their tastes and preferences have no real importance in the world, except that they throw the Golden Globes, which is typically the most fun party of award season because half of Hollywood is drunk and shoved into a ballroom at the Beverly Hilton in January.
It is quite a show to watch on television, to see all these people who normally are so put together in so many ways not be put together. It's kind of amazing when people were able to gather. Remember that, Rebecca, when we were all able to be in a room?
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I'm actually nostalgic for getting shoved into that ballroom, I have to admit.
Yeah, I can't wait for that sometime soon. All right, now, the Globes honor both TV and film, so let's talk about the film nominations, which they break into two categories, drama and musical or comedy. These are movies in the drama category, The Father, Mank, Nomadland, Promising Young Woman, and The Trial of the Chicago 7. Here's a clip from that.
It's a yes or no question. When you came to Chicago, were you hoping for a confrontation with the police? I'm concerned you have to think about it.
Give me a moment, would you, friend? I've never been on trial for my thoughts before.
All right, that was Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Sacha Baron Cohen, who we should say got three Golden Globe nominations today. Rebecca, what do you make of these drama picks?
Well, they're interesting. You know, all good movies, but what is noteworthy to me is that if this had been a normal year, more people would actually have seen these movies. The combined box office for this category is just a few hundred thousand dollars owing to Promising Young Woman, which has been out in theaters where they're open and in drive-ins. A couple of the movies are Netflix movies, Mank and Trial of the Chicago 7, so people have had the opportunity to see those. But Nomadland and The Father are not really available for wide audiences. And so I think there's going to be a little bit of an element of people just discovering these movies for the first time on the telecast.
There are a couple of films that I think some people might say, wait a second, I didn't hear that name. So which ones stood out that didn't make this drama list?
Well, Spike Lee's To Five Bloods is probably one of the surprises. This was also a Netflix movie, has done well with a lot of the critics leading up to this. Also noteworthy because his kids are the Golden Globe ambassadors this year, so that's just kind of awkward.
Now, okay, moving on to a musical or comedy. The nominees are Borat, subsequent movie film, Hamilton, Palm Springs, Music, and The Prom. Rebecca, what stands out to you about these nominations? I mean, cause it's kind of hard to compare the sort of mockumentary-style satire of Borat with the movie version of a Broadway musical in Hamilton. So what do you make of these nominations?
Yeah, this is a real hodgepodge, and it often is. You know, one thing that is nice about the Globes is that comedies, which typically get short shrift at the Oscars, do have a category here. The movie that had a lot of people scratching their heads this morning, though, is Music, this movie that was written and directed by Sia. I have not seen it yet, and I've seen everything else. This is a movie that has a 29% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes,
yeah.
And it's been part of a controversy over Sia's decision to cast an actress who is not autistic to play an autistic character. I wonder if part of the appeal to the HFPA was the many original songs Sia wrote for the film and the prospect of having her potentially perform one of them on the telecast.
Yeah, because I had to kind of look it up, too. So let's hear a clip, a clip of the trailer of Music.
There is, however, a magical little girl, your sister. All she's got now is you.
She can understand everything you are saying to her. And if you are happy, press this.
Very funny, troublemaker.
She sees the world in a completely different way from us.
We're about to have a pool party.
I am happy.
So you mentioned directed, written by the singer Sia. Rebecca, first off, this category always seems to be problematic every year, or almost every year, doesn't it? Musical or comedy?
Well, yeah, because there's a very apples and oranges component to it. As you say, how do you compare something like Hamilton, which was created for Broadway and has all these original songs, to something like the Borat movie, which is essentially an extended improvisation? They're very different. Frankly, they're the type of projects that, while very entertaining and widely seen, often get left out of the quote-unquote serious awards movie conversation. So there's something sort of refreshing about them being represented here. One of the movies that I was happy to see get a nomination was Palm Springs. This is the Hulu movie starring Andy Samberg. That's really smart and funny and different. One of the more original movies to come out in 2020. So it's nice that the Globes, with their strange categories, found a home for this one.
Now, in the Golden Globes director category, we're seeing something we have never seen before. Three women directors nominated out of five nominees. Did I see that correctly?
You did. Yeah, we've got Chloe Zhao for Nomadland, Regina King for One Night in Miami, and Emerald Fennell for Promising Young Woman. In the history of the Golden Globes, only five women directors have been nominated, and the last time that happened was Ava DuVernay. This year, women are the majority of the category. It's really quite remarkable.
Wow, the majority of the category. All right, that's something right there, at least. Now, taken as a whole, what do the Globe nominations today tell you about how Hollywood award shows are doing when it comes to spreading the love around a little bit, including a wider range of people working in the industry?
Well, there were some ways in which we saw more representation, as in the director category. There were, however, some kind of strange choices and some omissions. I think a lot of people were surprised to see the show I May Destroy You, created by Michaela Cole, not represented. Defy of Bloods, not represented. Those are both from Black creators. One of the films that had some controversy around it is this movie Minari, which takes place in the United States, but was only eligible in the Globe's foreign language category because 70% of the dialogue is in Korean. Some people feel like that is a strange rule. It's antiquated because it characterizes American as meaning just English speaking. So there were some ways in which there were steps forward for inclusion, representation in the industry, and other ways in which people felt like the Globes were just kind of making strange choices or antiquated choices.
Talking to Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. All right, in other awards of news, the Sundance Film Festival had their awards last night. That annual Indie Film Fest happened online this year, and some drive-in theaters elsewhere around the country also had it too. So one of the films that was the big winner at the awards was also the biggest sale of the festival. Rebecca, tell us about the movie Coda.
Yeah, Coda is a coming-of-age story. Coda stands for Child of Deaf Adults. The main character is a teenage girl who's the only member of her family who can hear. Deaf characters in the cast are played by deaf actors, including Marley Matlin. At Sundance, this movie won Best Director, Ensemble, Grand Jury Prize, Audience Award, just an astonishing sweep. Partly that's, I think, a reflection of the smaller slate this year, but also just of the quality of the film and the enormous emotional response that people had to it.
Yeah, and Apple bought this movie for $25 million. I mean, what do you make of the size of the sale?
Well, yeah, that was a record for the festival, and that number, 25 million, has a lot behind it. Part of it is that the streamers are absolutely ravenous for content at a time when people are watching streaming services more than ever, and people are not able to do as much production as they normally do. So there's been less product for them to choose from. Also noteworthy, I think, that it went to Apple and not one of the other streaming services. There's been, I think, a sense among some filmmakers that Netflix has so many movies right now that it's very hard to stand out on Netflix. Apple has fewer, so they can potentially put an enormous amount of marketing muscle behind this film that they've acquired and really make it stand out.
Rebecca, remember a few years ago when we were having these conversations about streaming services and when they all started to have their own content? Or I swore that, I'm going to have to choose. I can't have them all. I have them all.
Right.
I have them all.
I know. They got us now, don't they?
I know. I don't need to eat, I guess. Not as much.
I'm paying as much as I was when I had cable, which I no longer do. So I'm trying to figure out, this was supposed to be some sort of financial win for me, but it's not working out that way.
Yeah. All right. Finally, one more thing. We should address the fact that Jeff Bezos has announced that he's stepping down from Amazon. So wondering how this affects the TV shows and the movies that the Prime Video side greenlights. I mean, Amazon Studios is a big player, too.
Right. Well, Jennifer Salke, who runs Amazon Studios, is the person who makes the decisions about what shows and films Amazon backs, and she's staying in that role. But Bezos did weigh in on those decisions, and he had been something of a presence in the industry. He used to host an award season party at his house that I would go to, and he seemed to kind of enjoy getting to know Hollywood to some extent. Andy Jassy, who's taking over for him, has served as CEO of Amazon Web Services. That's the technology side of the company with a different culture. It'll be interesting to see how much he wants to get involved at the studio versus leave it to Salke to run.
The funny thing, though, so we talked about how, you know, I have all the streaming services now. I spend more time just surfing all the streaming services, looking for anything to watch that interests me. It's
I know.
It's weird. You buy all the services to have stuff to watch, and then you can't find anything to watch.
I just keep a little list on the notes app on my phone of stuff people have told me, shows and films, and then just I start there.
I know. Trust smarter people. That's the best thing to do.
That's the takeaway.
That's Rebecca Keegan, senior film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
And I do the same thing with podcasts, too. I'm just sitting there, just scrolling after podcasts, just trying to... I just think I have a bad commitment issue. I have a commitment issue, a phobia when it comes to streaming services and podcasts. Well, luckily for us, Nick Kwa, he's the host of Servant of Pod. He tells us some of the best podcasts to listen to, but he's going to take a look back coming up next on really the OG of podcasts, Serial. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, and you can hear Take Two podcast on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. It's that time of the week when we talk with our friend Nick Kwa, the go-to journalist covering the podcast industry and the host of LA Studios podcast Servant of Pod. And this week, he talks about the legacy of the one podcast that, I guess, arguably put podcasts on the map.
For the last year, I've spent every working day trying to figure out where a high school kid was for an hour after school one day in 1999. Or if you want to get technical about it, and apparently I do, where a high school kid was for 21 minutes after school one day in 1999.
Yeah, I'm talking about Serial, the investigative podcast that launched back in 2014. All right, so I'm going to admit something to you, Nick, that I used to be ashamed of, but I'm older now, so I don't care anymore. There are three things I have not seen or heard.
Oh, let's do this. Let's do this.
Yeah, Friends, the TV show, The Sopranos, and Serial. People used to shame me for it all the time, but you know what? You know, as I said, the older you get, the less you care. So Serial, tell us about Serial, produced by former This American Life producers. It became a massive hit in 2014. I know all that. So how did it all begin, and what was the podcast landscape before then?
Back before Serial's first season dropped in November 2014, you know, there were already a bunch of other kind of really popular podcasts that were coming up. But I think it was the sort of first genuinely big phenomenon, and it drove all these new listeners. It drove a ton of business interest. It drove a ton of investment and really kind of set the conditions to, you know, build the podcast industry that we know today. And also to sort of like build a lot of the genres that we know today. I don't think the notion of like one story week by week necessarily like existed in it with much ubiquity before that moment. And so, we're coming to the end of the first season of Servant of Pod, and I wanted to carve out some time to really like do a bit of history work, to really sort of lay down the foundations of, you know, what exactly happened here. I know it's been over-talked and overdone, but let's like really go back and properly try to historicize it and like unpack it with a certain sort of like eye towards a canon or a legacy here.
So Nick, in my defense, I was just kind of rewinding what I was doing in 2014. I was working here full-time at KPCC. I was working nights at ESPN Radio and then working weekends on Fox Sports TV. So I had very little time for anything else. So that is my story, and I'm sticking to it. All right, so in your episode about Serial, you're joined by New Yorker, a writer, Sarah Larson. Why did you choose her for this conversation?
Well, so she actually wrote a piece for The New Yorker before Serial came out, about a month before. It was titled Serial, the Podcast We've Been Waiting For. And she was offered like an inside look in the sort of making of it before it launched and kind of documented this sort of what in hindsight was like a pretty historical moment for this community, for this industry. And I want to bring her in because she was the person who sort of thought a lot about this during the initial run. When the first season came out, I was still sort of like, you know, a little bit like outside the media industry. And so I have yet to sort of really write about podcasts. And so we're trying to meet in the middle of like figuring out, okay, so what was the moment like in November 2014, in early 2015, when this thing was a phenomenon? And let's also unpack all the strands that lead us to podcasting as we know it today. The popularity of true crime, the sort of intensity of a certain kind of story, the intensity of like wanting to create like a podcast phenomenon. Let's just like kind of unfold all of that and, you know, kind of lay down a few stories here and there.
Now, you and Larson delved into the podcast's legacy today. So what conclusions did you both come to, and how has the show changed throughout three seasons?
So Sarah had this really interesting metaphor. She kind of like regarded Serial as like the Hamilton for podcasts in the sense that it drove interest among all these people who otherwise would not have cared about the medium.
Serial was the Hamilton of its time. That it was sort of like just the way that everyone fell crazily in love with this thing they might not have expected. You know, plenty of people who were not into Broadway musicals became obsessed with Hamilton. it made people fall in love with it and just invest in it in a way that if it had just been like more people were listening to This American Life on their phones, it wouldn't have been quite the same thing.
But in hindsight, I mean, the conclusion is that I think we're still, the industry and the ecosystem at large, still kind of living in the shadow of it. Like, there has yet to be another show that has, like, truly transcended that first phenomenon. And I think, you know, there's a bit of anxiety of, like, all right, we've built this, you know, industry around this place. People are making money. But can we sort of, like, hit the culture again and again and again and again? I think there's a lot of people trying for that. And there's a lot of people who are just perfectly happy to settle into this new world. But it's been sort of pretty interesting to see how even sort of subconsciously or unconsciously people are still thinking about that show in many ways. The show itself has changed pretty dramatically over the course of the next two seasons. The second kind of pushed off the true crime angle. And I should say that the Serial team itself probably would not have identified that first season as true crime. But the second season leaned harder into magazine-style feature journalism. It took on the case of Bo Bergdahl, the soldier who deserted his post in Afghanistan and got kidnapped by the Taliban. And the third season really kind of amped up the ambition. And it, you know, basically structured itself like the season of The Wire. Like, it's trying to look at the criminal justice system, but it did so by spending a year in one court building in Cleveland. So the show itself has changed an identity and an approach and in sort of ambition. And it's like it's always a little different, but yet there's something about it that feels very much like of a piece together.
Talking to Nick Kwa, he's the host of Servant of Pod and founder of the Hot Pod newsletter. Now, Serial made a huge impact on the culture, not just the podcast industry. Let's listen to a sketch from Saturday Night Live in 2014.
I'm Sarah Koenig. On December 25th, 1999, a small boy awoke in Baltimore, Maryland. He went down to his living room and found a Nerf N-Strike Mega Magnus Blaster. It's a mouthful, I know. That's the toy he wanted. The toy had no tag, no receipt. It was as if it appeared out of thin air. The boy maintained the toy had been brought by magic, by a mysterious man named Chris. But I had to ask myself, could Chris really have done this? And if so, how?
You know, one thing that Serial really did was it made the host and reporter, Sarah Koenig, a character herself. Nick, what sort of impact did this have on podcasts that followed?
One of the things that we see that's like a direct through line is the fact that we see a lot of true crime podcasts now. That's just a reality. Again, the Serial team would probably not identify that first season as true crime. But I mean, just, you know, think about a lot of the sort of popular Wondery shows, Dr. Death, Dirty John, that kind of thing. Yeah. A lot of the iHeartMedia shows. All these kinds of like, we're here to hear about an aberration, hear about a crime, and see if we can solve a mystery, solve a puzzle. But a lot of it, I mean, to some extent, it feels like, you know, it's kind of like the wrong thing to be taken away from Serial. Like, Serial was interesting in the sense that, like, it tried to do one story told week by week and sort of really unpack this thick, complicated, dense tale and approach it with a sort of an integrity and sort of approach it with a sort of intensity, which is pretty interesting. And so the sort of ambition of it, I think, is also another sort of big layer to its legacy. There are other teams trying to do similar things, play with similar ideas. And it feels like we're all within the same like kind of aesthetic parameters of like quote unquote prestige podcasting.
Now, I know you mentioned that the folks at Serial don't consider that first season true crime, but you know that people—that's how people associate Serial, whether they like it or not. What did Serial do to the popularity of the true crime genre and podcast today?
You know, it's interesting because like true crime as a media format, as a genre, right? It's always been popular, but I think what Serial, that first season Serial did, and what podcasting would then continue to do with the true crime genre as a whole, I think it gave an opportunity for the genre to feel new and exciting again. And again, like, you know, turn on any third HBO documentary. It's a true crime documentary, right? But there's something expected about it at this point. And the fact that we're seeing like stars being minted out of podcasting, true crime stars being minted out of podcasting, I think it says something a little bit interesting about the way we think about what's new, what's old, on top of something that's always been kind of eternal and evergreen.
Nick Kwa is host of the LA Studios podcast, Servant of Pod. New episodes are out each and every single Wednesday, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You know what you can also find on Apple Podcasts?
Take a guess. Take a guess. Us, your old pals, Take Two, wherever you get your podcast, there we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.